Italy's government has declared a 6-month national state of emergency to cope with asylum seekers reaching its southern shores. The state of emergency was announced right after Easter weekend, during which around 2,000 people arrived by boat on the island of Lampedusa. Members of the government admit that the state of emergency will not solve the issue. Civil Protection Minister Nello Musumeci, for example, stated, quotation here, "Let it be clear, we are not solving the problem. The solution can only depend on responsible intervention by the European Union." End of quotation. So, what does the Italian government want to achieve by announcing the state of emergency? And what does the situation in the Mediterranean look like right now from the perspective of the rescue operations? To help us answer those questions is Julia Mesmer, a spokesperson for a rescue ship Sea-Watch. Julia, thank you very much for joining the podcast. And let's go straight into the main topic, which is the state of emergency in Italy. What does it actually mean in general, the state of emergency, because it is a national state of emergency? And what does that mean for asylum seekers there?
Well, firstly, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm glad to speak with you today. And I mean, the state of emergency is a tool by the Italian government, allowing it to strengthen its system of deportation and thereby also the European border regime as a whole, as well as its own decision-making power on migration policies. So specifically, the Italian government declared a state of emergency for the next 6 months with an initial funding of approximately 5 million euro. And this includes a simplified procedure for the Italian government to take decisions regarding migration policies and measures in the country without going through the normal parliamentary process, meaning that the Italian government expanded its own power and lowered processes of checks and balances. And the statement that the Italian government published in line with the declaration of the state of emergency stated that they want to reduce arrivals on Lampedusa and back new structures in the asylum system and support deportations. But the situation in Italy and the European external borders as a whole are no emergency, as migration is never an emergency. The emergency narrative supports the fascist Italian government at the moment to claim that the country is overwhelmed, that exterior factors out of their control are responsible for the current situation. But this is actually not the case. The local situation and current situation is very much a political choice that builds on years and years of anti-immigration policies.
And what does that mean for asylum seekers? So there is actually a new law, actually a new whole immigration package that was actually voted right after the state of emergency. And it actually brings some more new developments potentially for asylum seekers, like new detention centers. Now everybody will have to actually wait in detention centers for the time of the process, the asylum process. So it is much harsher, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's like different laws or policy at the moment targeted by the Italian government. So firstly, there's the state of emergency, like you just mentioned. And the state of emergency intends to firstly create new reception facilities or hotspots to identify arriving persons and facilitate expulsion orders. Then secondly, it's also designed to create so-called pre-removal centers, one in each region of the Italy. So this structure is targeted, so arriving people are processed much faster and then are also deported much faster. This is the ultimate political aim. It's not to support arriving people to integrate in society and to like find a shelter, find a place to live, but it's much more targeted to how can we actually reduce arrivals to the country and then expel arriving people much faster. And to create this structure, now a commissioner was appointed, Valerio Valentini, and this commissioner is now trying to set up all these policies or implement all these policies. So far, the emergency state is on much more on paper than it's actually implemented, but of course it will now get implemented in the next months. And concretely for asylum seekers, this means that there will be a further and significant decline of reception facility standards, for example. then it will definitely increase the segregation between the Italian society and asylum seekers in the country. It will reduce the number of people recognized as having the right for protection, and it definitely, as said, increase also deportations. And then next to the state of emergency, there's also the Kultur decree, which is at the moment discussed in Parliament and in Italian society, Italian politics as a whole. And the Kultur decree is specifically targeted to firstly increase sanctions on so-called boat drivers. So people that have to, mostly are forced to drive the boats from their points of departures, such as Tunisia or Libya, to Italy. And that means that penalties will get much, much higher for people driving those boats. They can range between up to, I think, have a 10 to 20 years approximately. And keeping in mind that these are people fleeing, these are mostly not people involved in the smuggling system, because the smugglers and the organized structures are, of course, in the countries where people flee from, and they're not coming with people fleeing over the sea. That means Italy is criminalizing people fleeing directly to kind of build a narrative of, like, we're doing something against migration. We are handling this. We are really much like a strong government supporting the situation in Italy. But also, like, the measure is not really doing something against the situation at the moment.
I wanted to thank you for highlighting actually this issue, because the smugglers, or what the governments are calling smugglers, very frequently are just boat drivers, people who have no choice, basically, because if they want to leave the coast of Libya, Turkey, any other country in the Mediterranean, somebody has to steer it, and the smugglers are choosing the person who will steer, sometimes against their will. And now this new decree is actually implementing this new proposing this new law. I think it's called like smuggling with an end finale of death or something of this sort. So meaning that if you smuggle, it's one thing, you can be prosecuted for this, but if you smuggle and somebody dies, that's another category of smuggling, and those are really usually almost always not smugglers. And we saw it actually already in Greece happening, that people were sentenced to actually hundreds of years because they were prosecuted for every single person who died during this trip. So that's really important to highlight.
Definitely. And I think we always have to remember that, like, civil sea rescue organizations alone, but they always target migration to Greece, to the European Union, to Italy.
Exactly. It seems like there's really no law right now in the Mediterranean that would really truly target smugglers, the guys who operate on the other side. There's really nothing like this to my knowledge at the moment.
Well, I think it's very much a political game, and it's very much politically induced, the situation in Italy now specifically, and how we deal with people, how we treat people in reception facilities, but also how we criminalize people upon arrival.
Julia, let's speak for a moment about those high arrivals, because this is the main argument of the government to impose the state of emergency. We cannot deny that the numbers are much higher than last year. It's 31,000 people who have already arrived this year, and more than 400, I believe, have already died trying to reach Italy or Malta, basically the central Mediterranean. So can you tell us, where does this increase come from, and what are the people that are coming to Italy right now?
It's actually like in the Mediterranean as a whole, it's more than 600 people that already drowned, and in the central Mediterranean, more than 500. So we have a huge number of people having drowned in the last couple of months while crossing to the European Union. And I think we have to distinguish especially two factors. Of course, there's plenty, and it's not very like simple. It's always a complex conglomeration. But there's specifically two factors we could like differentiate. Firstly are the weather conditions. The weather conditions are much better in the first couple of months in 2023 compared to weather conditions in the last couple of years. We can definitely then make a connection to climate change and open to a much huger topic of how climate change actually fuels also flight and forced migration. But in terms of arriving numbers, this is definitely also a factor, because normally in this period of time, there's always like small windows of opportunity when weather conditions are okay to cross the central Mediterranean or the Mediterranean as a whole. And these windows are just bigger in the last couple of months. But then there's, of course, also the current situation in Tunisia, where a lot of people are now trying to flee from. And the current situation in Tunisia is a very complex one, but breaking it down, it's firstly a worsening economic situation. So we have an unemployment rate of about 15%, the inflation rate is about 10%, and the country lacks basic goods at the moment. Also, we see a lot of droughts, so water usage was restricted, meaning that, for example, in the cities of Sfax, Sousse, also the capital, Tunis people, black people were subjected to acts of violence, found themselves without shelter, without food, were deprived of their basic rights to health and transportation. But they not only faced violent instances personally or directly, they also faced institutional racism with racial profiling, for example, arrest, arbitrary detention, were forcibly disappeared. And that led also to, of course, a huge outcry in our bubble, but also from activists inside of Tunisia. And also there was a protest actually happening in front of the International Organization for Migration and the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, where around 250 people protested and demanded the immediate evacuation from the country because their lives were in danger. And this demonstration was then forcibly evicted on April 11th, so really cracking down on migration, on protests, on activists speaking up about the current situation in Tunisia.
Can we go right now to the situation upon arrival? So most people who travel through the Mediterranean to Italy reach the island of Lampedusa. And Lampedusa has been a hub basically ever since the travel, the journeys through the Mediterranean started. It's a very small island. We saw and we heard terrifying stories of people drowning right off the coast, about the conditions on the island. So how does it look like right now on Lampedusa and in the south of Italy in those reception centers?
And important is to say at first that the situation on Lampedusa is quite unique, so it's not really generalizable or comparable to the rest or the situation in the rest of Italy. But the infrastructure on Lampedusa is at the moment definitely overwhelmed out of political intention. Again, I really have to stress that point going back, because the migration route to Lampedusa is established since years now, and politically Italy has not much done to increase and to better infrastructure on the island. So Lampedusa has a very limited infrastructure when it comes to arriving asylum seekers. The hotspot only has 300 to 400 places and is definitely overburdened at the moment with arriving persons. But the structures per se, they do not fail. They work exactly like they are designed, because right-wing narratives in the last years have established this hotspot structure that we see in Italy, and specifically when we're talking about Lampedusa on the island. And so we can really say the situation on Lampedusa is homemade. The situation on the island is, of course, Italian responsibility, but the situation at the external borders is European responsibility. So we really need a functioning redistribution mechanism so people can live in dignity, because this is the most like harsh condition on the island as well, when we see people arriving are put in a camp which is not structured for that many people. So people have no way of having any kind of private sphere. People are living or are sleeping outside in the summer, for example, and are really like have to really fight for their place in this structure. So what we really have to like look out for now is functioning redistribution mechanisms, not only inside the country of Italy, but in the European Union as a whole.
And actually, the Italian government is demanding some kind of an action from the European Union, saying that even the state of emergency is not going to do the job. It's not going to actually slow down the migration. And a responsible, as they claim it, the responsible answer from the European Union needs to be found. And now the question is, what kind of response would that be? What do they feel like it should be? And in your opinion, Sea-Watch opinion, what needs to actually be done to help the situation in the central Mediterranean?
So firstly, of course, one thing, and that is state financed and state rescue programs, sea rescue programs in the central Mediterranean, but not only in the central Mediterranean, but the Mediterranean as a whole, and also, of course, in the Aegean, because sea rescue is a state duty. This is demanded by various international law, and what we see at the moment is a huge gap, a huge void that has to be filled by civil sea rescue organizations, but it's not our job to do so, and we can only just be a patch on this current situation. We need states, we need the European Union to really act upon the current situation where hundreds of people are drowning, dozens of people are drowning each day. And this is a very much politically induced situation. But I mean, as I said, as a second point, I would really stress as well, a functioning redistribution mechanism inside the European Union to really take care of arriving people to the continent, but also to the European Union itself, and to really take care within different countries.
You already mentioned the sea rescue operations. You work for Sea-Watch, one of the rescue missions in the Mediterranean. There is a new law, and that works very much against you and other ships. But before we go into it, I think it's very interesting for everybody to know how a rescue operation actually looks like from your perspective. How are you getting the information that a boat is in distress? How are you reacting in normal conditions?
So first, I would like to say that we and Sea-Watch has ship operations, but also flight operations, which we call airborne operation. But when it comes to ship operations, so our rotations usually last from 4 to 5 weeks, and the crew is composed of volunteers and actually also employed maritime crew on board. So a rescue operation not only starts at the sea directly, but very much starts with preparation. So first, we have a week of briefings, of trainings, of drills with all the crew to really ensure a tight crew and like a really connected crew, because this is very much essential to work together then on a very confined situation at sea. But also we want to continuously ensure the safety not only of the crew but also later of the guests on board, and this is why we take a very huge focus on the trainings before we actually start the mission. And then after the trainings are done, we normally patrol for around 2 weeks in the area of operations, which is between 40 to 60 nautical miles off the Libyan coast. And I mean, we have established a certain search pattern, so we do not cross from one point to the other just randomly, because then we wouldn't have an overview of where we potentially searched already and where boats could be. But we establish a search pattern, and then during the daylight we look out with binoculars, basically, and we are trying to search for boats in distress. But as now I said, we not only have ship operations, but also the airborne operation. We also closely communicate with our reconnaissance aircrafts or observing aircrafts that also fly a search pattern over the central Mediterranean Sea. And of course, if they find boats in distress, they communicate to us, or they communicate to other ships in the region, civil sea rescue ships, but also merchant vessels, but also, of course, the coast guards. And then until a few years ago, we received information also from governmental rescue centers, which does not happen anymore. So we mostly do not get any information from the Maltese or the Italian rescue coordination centers. But we do get information from an initiative called Alarm Phone. Alarm Phone is an emergency hotline that can be called by people at distress at sea. And they will then communicate to all surrounding boats in the area that there is an emergency at sea and we will request help and support for the people on this boat or rubber dinghy mostly. So if we get this information from these various sources, and once we then find the boat, we launch our rescue operation, meaning that the team on board prepares the deck and launches to so-called RIPS, so smaller boats that then go to the boat in distress, do a first assessment, and also like really try to take care of the people in terms of calming down the situation and distributing life jackets. Because of course, the people in distress are threatened, are really like scared for their life. So the situation can be very, very dangerous as well, like during rescue operations. But once we distributed life jackets, we then shuttle people one by one or as many people as the RIP can take to the mothership. So potentially in a few months to the Sea-Watch 5, which will hopefully go into mission in the next few months as well. But so the most important points are firstly stabilized boats, then giving out life jackets, and then bringing the people to the mothership. And then once the people are on the mothership, we do a first assessment, like firstly medic-wise, so we do a first triage and see, okay, which people do need immediate help and which people can actually first like go on deck and really find a place. They will be given a blanket, they will be given water to have their first, like their basic needs met when they are on the ship, because they come from a very, very stressful situation. Potentially, they were at sea for several days before we had the chance to rescue them. And then the work the living on board begins. Like normally, or before before the decree in the beginning of the year was adopted, we stayed in the area of operation and also rescued other boats in distress, because this is our duty according to maritime law. And then when our ship was couldn't take any more people in distress, we headed north. So we went from rescue time to standoff time, and then we request a port of safety, meaning that we communicate with the competent authorities and we do have to wait until we are assigned a port of safety. And just a few days ago, I actually talked to a colleague of mine who is a guest coordinator on our ships. And he explained to me like how his work is done while the guests are on board. And it's very much also about crowd management. It's about interaction between the crew and the people who were just rescued. So it's not only about giving out basic necessities like water and food and potentially showers, but it's also very much coming in close contact, talking with people, seeing what people need psychologically, medically, as well as just in their state of waiting, because being rescued firstly means a long, long waiting time mostly until we can bring people and our guests then to the port of safety in Italy potentially.
I very much like that you call people whom you rescue guests on your board. That's very positive. Thank you. Yeah, so now you have your guests on board. You're trying to reach the nearest port, but this has been a challenge for the last few years. We saw that some captains have been arrested for this. Carola Rackete was arrested. She was finally cleared of all charges, but it was a long process. She entered the port without the consent of the port authorities. And now the new law in the Mediterranean forces you to actually go to a designated port by the authorities, and very frequently those are ports that are very far away from you.
Yes, correct. So there's actually, again, two measures we have to differentiate. Firstly, the practice of distant ports, like you just outlined. So when rescue ships at the moment are assigned port of safeties in Italy, they're very much in the north. So just a couple of days ago, the SOS Humanity, the ship, the Civil Sea Rescue ship, SOS Humanity rescued dozens or approximately 70 people from distress at sea. And then they were assigned Ravenna as port of safety. Ravenna is much in the north of Italy, and it was approximately 1,600 kilometers from the area of operation of the of SOS Humanity, of the Humanity Wonder Ship. Meaning, this is a distance, just to clarify, between Berlin and Kiev, plus an additional 300 kilometers. So one can imagine how long it takes for a ship to actually make that distance and actually go and enter into the port of safety. This puts so much additional stress on the guests, but of course also on the crew. But the guests are like, after the rescue and after having been on the sea and in distress for potentially several days, already deteriorating health conditions. So if the weather conditions then are also worsening during the way through the ports of safety, this is such a stressful situation for all of the people on board. So this is just unnecessarily putting people at risk to prevent civil sea rescue ships to be in areas of operation, to really prevent us doing our work.
And so we know that the ports in the north of the country are more refugee-friendly. Generally, the cities seem to be more refugee-friendly rather than the south. So this even shows it more that this is a politically motivated issue, because usually the ports designated for embarking are the ports in the north. You are not fully operational because of this law right now. Am I correct?
Yes, partly. Sea-Watch still has one ship, the Sea-Watch 3, under is blocked in Italy. The Sea-Watch 5, our new operational rescue ship, will go out hopefully in a couple of months. It's at the moment prepared in the shipyard in Flensburg and will then make its way to Buriana. But of course, lots of other civil sea rescue organizations are currently operational in the Mediterranean. So, for example, the ships Geobarons, Ocean Viking, CI4, the Humanity One, as just given in the example, are very much operational. And they are hindered by this new practice of distant ports, but also with the new decree that entered into force in the beginning of the year.
It seems like the Coast Guard, Italian Coast Guard, is more active right now in actually participating in rescue operations. So they also rescue people from the sea. How different are their rescue operations from the ones you are providing?
Yeah, so firstly, I would like to very much talk about this narrative that the Italian Coast Guard is now more active on the Central Mediterranean, because we have to talk about why do we see this development. And then for this, we have to go back to the situation at the moment in the Central Mediterranean, which very much puts a focus on Italy, because so many people are drowning or are actually like no assistance is rendered to them, and this is why they die on their migration, on their journey from, for example, Tunisia and Libya to Italy. But on the other side, next to the operations of the Italian Coast Guard, we still see so many delays. We still see so much failure to provide assistance by Italy, but also by the Coast Guard of Malta, which we also have to talk about, because Malta is currently, but also in the last couple of years, really preventing cooperation between its Coast Guard and civil sea rescue organizations, for example. So sea rescue cases are mostly known for days without a response of state structures. And if Italy reacts and if they cooperate at all, is when boats are in the Italian SAR zone, but not, for example, if they're still in the Maltese SAR zone and very close to the Italian SAR zone, even though we all know, and also the Italian Coast Guard knows, that the Maltese Coast Guard is not operational and is not supporting. So we see, on the one side, operations by the Italian Coast Guard, which does its job. And I think this is what we really have to emphasize. The Coast Guard, the Italian Coast Guard, their job is to rescue people at sea. So every time we see rescue operations, it's because it's off their job, and it's not because it's something special or it's something extra. It's because they are doing their job. And on the other side, we still see the Coast Guard very much overwhelmed with the sheer number of boats in distress. So, and at the same time, they are very often refusing to cooperate with civil sea rescue organizations. So we still see the Coast Guard as a very much political tool of the Italian government that now increases its operations because all international eyes are on the borders of Italy, all international eyes are on the European external borders because so many people are drowning in the last couple of months.
Thank you very much, Julia. It is really worth highlighting at the end that whenever we hear those news that Italian Coast Guard rescued that and that many people, when the Greek Coast Guard rescued that and that many people, they are actually doing their job, and we really see it as something very unusual because they very frequently sabotage those rescue operations. Thank you very much for being a guest on our podcast today. We spoke to Julia Messmer, a spokesperson for Sea-Watch. Thank you for listening to Fractured. Our podcast is produced by Refocus Media Lab's citizen journalists from Afghanistan, Iran, Ukraine, and many other countries. It is partly financed by Allianz Foundation and Choose Love. However, it is thanks to donations from individual people like you that we can continue our mission of teaching media skills to refugees and asylum seekers and give them a platform to showcase their work. So if you value this podcast and our work, please support us on refocusmedialabs.org/donate.